Good morning, everyone. So today we'll embark on a new stage with King Asvapati. We read about the kingdoms of the greater life and how, despite all their achievements, they gave the feeling that an error of the gods has made the world, or indifferent, the eternal watches time. There's the longing for extinction, but that is not allowed. So he embarks onto the descent into night. Earlier on page 135 in the Kingdoms of the Little Life, in a kind of introductory section, Shobindo had explained that in order to discover the roots of the problem of life, King Asvapati must go down. He must follow the path of life, even from her faint and dim subconscious star. So only can Earth's last salvation come. For so only could he know the obscure cause of all that holds us back and baffles God. So he has to go down into the depths. And that is what is described in the Canto 7 and 8. We'll start by reading Canto 7 on page 202. We started to read, perhaps. Where did we read to? To page 208. So we've read the first two sections, is it like that?
Yeah. 208, I think.
So shall we start at the beginning and we'll look sentence by sentence, and when we reach the break on page 208, then we'll continue with our reading. Perhaps we'll start at the top today. Praveen, would you start, please?
Canto 7, the descent into night. Mind absorbed from life, made calm to know, the heart divorced from the blindness and the pain, the seal of tears, born of ignorance, he turned to find that wide world barriers fall. Away he looked from nature's visible space and sent his gaze into the viewless cause, formidable unknown infinity, asleep behind the endless coil of things that carries the universe in its timeless breath. And the ripples of its being are alive. The worlds are built by its unconscious breath, and matter and mind are its figures for its powers. Our waking thoughts, the output of its dreams.
Thank you. So this is Asvapati. He has become a mind absolved from life. He's not affected by the movements of life. His mind has become very calm to face whatever he may observe, and his heart has also become desireless and pure, divorced from the blindness and the pang, the seal of tears, the bond of ignorance. Having reached that state of equality, strength, he turned to find the cause of this wide world failure that he has observed in Canto 6. That even the highest levels of life cannot satisfy us or give us the solution. So he looks away from nature's visible face. He's this penetrating inner gaze that he has achieved. He sent into the viewless vast of unseen, unseeable vastness, and formidable, unknown infinity, which is sleeping behind the endless coil of things. That vast carries the universe in its timeless breadths, and our lives are the ripples of its being. The worlds of the universe are built by its unconscious breath, and matter and mind are its figures, its representatives, or its powers. Our waking thoughts are the output of the dreams of that sleeping, unconscious vastness. So what does he see, Srinivas?
The veil was rent that covers nature's depths. He saw the form of the world's master's pain, and the mouth of the black pit of ignorance, evil guarded at the roots of life, raised up its head and looked into his eyes. On a dim bank where lies subjective space, from a stark ridge overlooking all the rays, tenebrous, awakened nations, the wide black eyes, wondering at time and form, stared at the inventions of the living void and the abyss whence our beginnings rose.
Thank you. With the power of his gaze, he tears away the veil that covers the deep, dark levels of nature. So he is able to see the fount, the source of the world's lasting pain, and the mouth of the black pit of ignorance, that dark pit where ignorance emerges as if exhalations from a deep pit. The evil guarded at the roots of life raised up its head and looked into his eyes. It's the image of the tree of existence, and gnawing away at its roots, there's a worm, there's a serpent, which is the embodiment of evil. We read about it on page 8, where on the last line of page 8, Aurobindo tells us that what Savitri has done, what her mission is, it's against the evil at life's afflicted roots. Of her pangs, she made a mystic, poignant sword to destroy that evil. It's an image from Norse, Scandinavian mythology, that the cosmos, the universe, is a tree, and something is always gnawing away at the roots of that tree so that it grows crooked and gives bitter fruit. So he sees that serpent there. It raises up its head and looks into his eyes. And Aurobindo describes it. That serpent is lying on a ridge which overlooks everything that is. There's a consciousness, a shadowy, tenebrous, awakened nescience, a power without knowledge. Her wide, blank eyes looking, seeing the world and time. There she's staring at all the inventions of the living void, this emptiness which she sees, and the abyss, the deep pit from which our beginnings have arisen. Yes?
In the beginning of this canto, he's talking about the state of mind.
State of consciousness of Asvapati.
So with that kind of mind, one can enter into the...
Yes.
If you want to do, then you have
louder, louder, louder. Everyone wants to hear.
Ramanarayan is saying that you have to have this kind of consciousness, like King Asvapati, before you can dare to make this exploration. I think that's what you meant, no? That it's not wise for us, with our present limited consciousness, to attempt these explorations.
If we descend into this state of knowing, or it's possible to get there.
They get stuck and then they need help to get out. Yes. Mm-hmm. It happens.
What Ramanand is saying is correct according to you. You have to have that level of consciousness to go down into your subconscious.
It's not advisable to attempt unless you have become a mind absolved from life, with totally without attachment, made calm to know. Then you can, when your heart is divorced, you are able to stand separate from all the blindness and the pang and the ignorance. When your spirit is able to step back from all that, then you can make this journey.
But as I believe, right from the beginning, we have to work from the top and from the bottom.
First, we have to go up. That's what Asvapati has done.
He reach that level. But what I've read till now, Sri Aurobindo, right from the beginning, you have to start from taking help from the above and going down also a little bit, not to that depth.
Not to this depth. Whatever comes up from that depth, you can offer to the heights. But if I am right, of course, Sri Aurobindo has said many, many things and to different people who had different work to do. But on the whole, he said, it's not advisable for us while we're in this ordinary limited consciousness to go exploring into these dark depths. And we will see what an ordeal it is, even for King Aswapati. That's all I have to say on the topic. So, first of all, he sees this, I think, a kind of serpent force, the evil guarded at the roots of life. But then he sees something else, the next thing. Chitra, would you read? Let's pause there, Chitra. So behind that evil presence, which is a shadowy, tenebrous, awakened nescience, a not knowing, behind that appears a mask, a grey carved mask of night. And something behind that mask is watching the birth of all created things. And that is a hidden puissance, a hidden power which is conscious of its force. It is not nescience just waking up. That expresses itself, or Aswapati perceives it, as a vague and lurking presence everywhere, everywhere in our world. A contrary doom that threatens all things made. With all our aspirations, we want to make a better world. But once we really try that, we become aware of something else, which seems to be always obstructing and opposing. Something like a power of death, figuring as the dark seed of life, as if all creation, all living things, have actually been born from some power of death. That power of death seems to engender, to give birth to, and to slay the world. In Book 10, when Savitri is facing death, he claims this right, no? That he's the one who's given rise to everything, and he's the one who will and can slay everything. So Aswapati sees something like that, a power which seems to give birth to everything in the world and also to slay it. And then there's a next step. Would you read? Yes, you please.
Then, from the sound of mystery of the gods and from the hollow bosom of the mass, something crept forth that seemed a shapeless thought, a fatal influence upon creature's soul, whose lethal touch pursued the immortal spirit when life was made the haunting finger of death, and overcast with error, grief, and pain. The soul was made known for truth and joy and light, a deformation world that claimed to be the being's very turn, nature's true drive.
Thank you. So from that dark mystery of the abyss, the depths, and out of this mask, from the hollow, empty bosom of the mask, something crept forth. It's like a poisonous gas flowing out, but it seems to be a shapeless thought, an influence, a fateful influence, an influence that kills. and that's just stealing upon creatures without anybody noticing, no? Only King Aswapati sees it. The influence of that lethal touch, that deadly touch, is pursuing, following the immortal spirit, and it's laying the finger of death on all life. And it's even affecting the soul. It's overcasting like a dark cloud of error, grief, and pain. It's shadowing the soul's native will. The natural will of the soul is to turn towards truth and joy and light. But this dark shadow is there, and it's causing a deformation, which is saying that no, actually, the real turn of nature, the real drive of nature, is not like that.
Mm. You know that I like to connect to the real life.
Yes.
The cigarette companies promoting cigarette actually destroying the willpower.
Yes.
And they are very powerful. They are
yes. It's a manifestation of something similar. Yes. But the cigarette companies wouldn't have any influence, have any power over us, if we were listening to our souls. No? But this influence is perverting, deforming the soul's natural turn.
Yeah, to be a man, you need to smoke.
They convince you of that, yes.
Here is put capital on all negative things, and like timeless spirit, immortal species.
The small one, yeah.
Yes.
Will you read, please, huh? Line 42, a hostile and perverting mind.
Hostile and perverting mind and world in every corner in front of conscious life. Forces truth with her own corners, interceptor of the reasoning of the soul, afflicting knowledge with a few of thoughts, it captured oracles offered pass, the face, the signpost of life, pilgrimage. Hence, the form, rock, elite by nine, and all the foundations of the cosmic law, erected, strong, violent, of misery.
Thank you. Ensconced, it means established, fixed there. That mind is fixed in every corner of conscious life, and it's corrupting truth with her own formulas. If we think of truth in terms of formulas, they can be corrupted, perverted. That mind, Aswapati sees it intercepting the listening of the soul. When we try to listen, or the soul tries to listen to the truth, this power comes in between. It afflicts knowledge with the hue of doubt, makes us doubt. Is it really true? Is it really so? It captured the oracles of the occult gods who are there to give us messages. It controls those oracles so that the messages come out false. And on the very foundation of the cosmic law, the law of the universe, it erects, it puts up its bronze pylons of misrule. There's something about this combination of words which is very suggestive and terrifying, actually. Bronze is a metal, a mixture of metals that lasts for a long time. And we use it for putting up monuments. And these are like obelisks, pylons, columns, but what they are, what's carved on them, or what they are standing for, it is misrule, disorder.
What does she say with her?
This is
her
this
own
truth. We think of truth as a goddess.
I thought it was referring to mind.
Well, here he says corrupted truth with her own formulas. So the formulas of truth. So we misinterpret the words of truth. We turn them to suit our own preferences.
What is efface?
To efface something. it's happened in some of our Oroville signposts. Yeah. Somebody has come along and nicely effaced them. So we can't, we don't know which way we're supposed to go. Effaced, wiped out the signposts of life's pilgrimage that would point us the right way to go. There's no indication there. It's been removed. And there are, at the basis of the cosmic law, before these bronze pylons of misrule came up, there were these firm rock edicts graved by time, giving the rules by which life should be lived. Of course, here in India, there are ancient remains of prehistoric rock edicts erected by rulers in the past who wanted to give good guidance to their people. They're important archaeological remains. They're carved in stone, like the tablets of Moses, so that they will last forever. But these have been cancelled out. And then on the foundations where that cosmic law should stand, instead, these bronze pylons of misrule. Andres, will you read?
Your life and love, by that hope in your spell, turn from the brilliant nature of the glass. The fallen angels and his leading sons became themselves a danger and a charm, a perverse sweetness, heaven-born melodies. Its power could perform divinest things. A wind of sorrow breathed upon the world, of thought with falsehood was besieged. A lad stamped with defect or with frustration's sign. All high attempt with failure or vain success. The none could know the reason of his fall. The great mask whispered, and though no sound was heard, yet in the ignorant heart a seed was sown that bore the black fruit of suffering, dead and dead. Out of chill steps of a weak, unseen, invisible, wearing the night's gray mask, arrived the shadowy, dreadful messengers, invaders from a dangerous world of power, ambassadors of people's absolute. In silence, the inaudible voices spoke, hands that none saw planted the fatal grain. No form was seen, yet a dire work was done. An iron decree in crooked unshells, written imposed a law of sin and adversity.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything? Unshells. Yeah, they are. It's a kind of writing, black ink on parchment, and it was used at a time when there wasn't much reading and writing going on, so for official documents. So
an archaic
script, exactly. Long ago, this form of writing was used, and perhaps it was used mainly for writing laws and decrees. So here it says in crooked uncials, so they're even more difficult to read. This is these ambassadors, no?
Bail,
misfortune, disaster.
Physical suffering or woe.
Sorry?
Physical suffering or woe.
Woe, yeah, bail, great misfortune.
Misleading sense.
Sorry, misleading sons. Yes, if you don't, if you're in a strange place and you want to orient yourself, one good way is to find out where the light is. Where is the sun? If you know where the sun is. But these are misleading sons. They're giving you wrong directions. These shadowy, dreadful messengers, we don't perceive them, no? But they are creeping behind the fair outsides of life and spreading their influence. They, in this case, what King Asvapati sees on these lower levels of existence, these are really ambassadors of evil's absolute. They're spreading really bad influences. And they speak silently. There are people planting seeds of disaster. There are beings planting seeds of disaster. But nobody sees them doing it. No form was seen. And yet that dire work was done. sort of iron decree. It suggests these terrible dictatorships, these regimes where there's no space given for individual freedom. And it's written in these crooked, baleful letters that those decrees impose a law of sin and adverse fate. It seems to be impossible for the soul to live its native turn of truth and light and love. Who's sitting next to Andras? Sorry, I can't see. Would you read, please, Paula?
Life looked at him with changed and somber eyes. Her beauty he saw and the yearning heart that was a little happiness is content, answering to a small ray of truth or love. He saw her gold sunlight, her far blue sky, her green of leaves and hue and scent of flowers, and the charm of children, and the love of friends, and the beauty of women, and the kindly hearts of men, but saw too the dreadful powers that drive her moons, and the anguish she has strewn upon her ways. Fate waiting on the unseen steps of men, and her evil and sorrow and last gift of death. A breath of disillusion and decadence, corrupting, watched for life's maturity, and made to rot the full grain of the soul. Progress became a purveyor of death.
Thank you. The grain of the soul becomes full, complete, but this power makes it rot. So painful. Sorry? A purveyor. It's a person who supplies things. Oh, I think of my country, England. There we often see on products or above the doors of shops that they are authorized purveyors of something to Her Majesty the Queen. It can be sweets or leather or anything. A purveyor. It's somebody who supplies something. So here it's a purveyor of death. No? Progress. You grow, the soul matures, but that very progress brings about death.
The grain,
you grow rice or you grow wheat, and it grows a grain, a seed. No, that's the good part. That's the product. But unfortunately, it happens when you harvest that grain, if you don't keep it carefully in the right conditions, it starts to rot.
I don't get how or why progress became the value of death.
Well, it's connected with the previous line.
Yes.
That, the soul matures to a certain point, but then this distorting influence cuts short the progress. The progress becomes, the next thing it can give you is only death. The grain becomes full, then we cut down the plant. Of course, if we use the grain, if we keep it, use it wisely, it goes on giving more life. But here he's saying, it gets corrupted, it gets rotten, it gives only death.
From the point of view of spiritual evolution, what's the purpose of these beings?
I can't say anything about their purpose, but there's a chapter in The Life Divine where Sri Aurobindo speaks about the cause and the cure of error, falsehood. Somebody help me. I can't. Four things: pain, suffering. And basically, the cause is ignorance. Ignorance combined with desire. Sorry, Naren.
No, I just see the purpose being, they give you an opportunity to improve yourself. You have an opponent and you fight against that and you improve yourself. The reason for this existence.
I don't know really whether that's the reason. The cause. I mean, these things are... Mother has said it's monstrous to think that the divine has deliberately caused these things to be there. It's not like that. The intention also of life, when she poured all her gifts into matter, it was something else, to fill a fair new world with joy. But there's been this meeting of life with matter, with the unconsciousness of matter, and that has caused this distortion. So all of us human beings, we've all creatures, we've all evolved up out of this distortion, this crookedness. So the soul, of course, within also grows. It is pure, but when it's only got these crooked instruments to deal with, it can't express itself. Here, this is one of the things he mentioned. No? There's the soul's native turn towards truth and light and love. That's the first thing that these influences want to distort.
I wonder if these four lines are talking about aging. Because Mother said the way you stop aging is progress, no? So it says it watched for life's maturity. And the thing that caused that, the corruption, was caused by disillusion and decadence. I remember Alok Pandey saying that oftentimes older people get cynical about life. They've seen a lot, they've done a lot, and they're kind of fed up and critical of things. So if that happens, that's a kind of corruption. It says it watches for life's maturity. And then you begin, your soul is no longer progressing, then you it becomes a purveyor of death.
Right.
Too bad.
Better to avoid it if possible, no? A youth that never ages would be the cure.
So the state of mind is more important perhaps than anything.
State of consciousness is always more important than anything else.
In this passage, the first part speaks about the beauty of life.
Yes, so Asvapati is able to see all those beautiful aspects of life. Yes.
And the second part talks about the anguish and the disillusion and all these things.
Which are also there, no?
Yeah, in human life we see them.
Yes.
But it said here, saw through the dreadful powers. So what are these powers?
I think these are these dreadful powers, which we're going to read more about, which are born out of this, what he calls in one place, a dolorous meeting of the pure life power with all these lower influences, distorting influences, which we read about in various places, but especially here in Cantos 7 and 8.
Is anything maybe that puts you in a bad mood?
More than a bad mood, bad state. Yeah.
Encouragement, anger, irritation.
Yeah. Shall we read on? Who is next? Vidya, would you read?
The world that clung to the law of the ceiling and cherished pale, twisted forms as things real, new and true, beauty from ugliness and evil drank, feeling themselves guests at the banquet of the gods. And tasted corruption like a high spiced food. A darkness settled on the heavy air. It hunted the bright smile from nature's lips, and smeared the native confidence and put fear's crooked look into her eyes. The lust that walks the spirit's natural good, replaced by a manufactured virtue and vice, the frank, spontaneous impulse of the soul. Afflicting nature with a great man, their twin values vetted a forbidding zest, making good a relief from spurious good.
Let's pause there. Oh, sorry. Go to the end of the sentence. Yeah, so sorry.
The ego battling on righteousness and sin, and each became an instrument of hell.
Thank you. There's something like this at work in our world, no? Through progress, perhaps. Clinging to the law of a slain light, cherished putrid corpses of dead truths. We can think of the religions, perhaps. But on the other hand, we're also hailing twisted forms, distorted, perverted forms, as things free, new, and true. Very distressing to see so many young people drinking beauty from ugliness and evil, feeling themselves guests at a banquet of the gods, tasting corruption like a high-spiced food. So in that state, in that world, there's this darkness. It's like a heavy cloud of darkness which drives away the bright smile which should be there on nature's lips. Destroys the native confidence, the trust that should be in her heart, put fear's crooked look into her eyes. human beings do so many terrible things just out of fear. And the lust, the perverted craving that warps the spirit's natural good, replaced by a manufactured virtue and vice. Again, we see this in society. You know, there are rules about what is good to be done and what is bad to be done. And this can become terribly perverted. The frank, spontaneous impulse of the soul to do the right thing gets distorted. So this afflicts nature with the lie, the falsehood of duality, of virtue and vice. And these twin values, whetted, sharpened, like sharpening the blade of a knife, a forbidden zest. It makes vice seem exciting and interesting. It makes evil a relief from spurious good. Maybe not from real good, but from pretend good, false good. It's natural for the ego then to batten, to greedily eat righteousness and sin. And both the righteousness and the sin, each of them becomes an instrument of hell, of a very dark, perverted state.
Batten means
beaten? Batten, no. It's there are certain kinds of disgusting fish that live at the bottom of the sea. They have these horrible mouths, and they batten on dead fish that fall down from above. It's eating greedily.
How can righteousness become an instrument of hell?
When self-righteousness very easily can. And you think you're so good, and you've forgotten all about the frank, spontaneous impulse of the soul. The duals lie, yes. The lie of duality, that this is good and that is bad, no? In a formal way, according to our human morality. It's not that there's no difference between evil and good, but perhaps there's not the difference that we think there is between virtue and vice or sin. That's our false human way of looking at things. We hesitate to do things spontaneously because we want to be respectable and people should, you know.
Talks about do-gooders.
Do-gooders, yes. But they're, yes. Do-gooders are not always doing good, you know. Under the table, they may be doing all kinds of things.
And so for this reason, may evil relieve from
spurious good. Yes, spurious good that is spurious, fake. Yeah.
But here it doesn't mean other dualities like happiness or sadness. For good and bad is okay, right and wrong. Other dualities of life, here it's also good.
I think when we really progress in yoga, the spontaneous impulse of the soul doesn't see this distinction, you know, this moral distinction that we human beings see. Well, there's for example, the legend of Auroville. You know this story about the Swami from the village? From Irumbai village, I think it is. Yeah?
Yeah?
You tell the story, Rita. There was a festival at the temple, and there was a dancing girl. She was dancing so beautifully. The Siddha was sitting and watching along with all the other people. And as she danced, her anklet became unhooked. And she lost it. And then the Siddha left his seat and picked up the bracelet and fastened it around her ankle again so she could continue with her dance. But then all those good people in the village, they began to quietly, well, perhaps they tittered and perhaps they said things behind their hands and so on. So then the Siddha was so disgusted by this spurious good, you know, that he cursed the village. He said, nothing's going to grow here for 500 years. Something like that, he said, no?
Meenakshi, a lot of Indian, long time ago, going to temple of Irumbai.
It's the story of Irumbai temple, yes.
She 100 years.
Oh, okay. Well, however long it was. Yes, however long it was, for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And then everybody apologized and begged him and said, please lift the curse. And he said, I can't lift the curse, but I can see into the future that a day will come when people will come from all over the world, and then this area will become prosperous again. Something like that is the legend.
Plant trees.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Rita. Yes. Yeah. So this spurious good, no?
Well, is this force or dark night, is it related to the hostile forces?
It is the hostile forces.
It is the hostile forces. Is it does it have a specific name? Because there are four main hostile forces.
What are they?
Forces.
Yes.
Which one do you identify?
Yes.
The Lord of the Nations. The Lord of the Nations was a force.
Well, these are, yes, the mother said unconsciousness, falsehood, death, desire, I think. There were these four asuras, these four great beings who were sent to create this world. And they were light, consciousness, life.
Love.
Love is not mentioned. Power, I think. Maybe knowledge, consciousness. No. So, but they, as they were sent to do their task, they felt themselves so powerful that they cut off the connection with their origin. And then each of them turned to the opposite. So the light, the consciousness, became unconsciousness, and the power became weakness, and life became death. Bliss became suffering. So when the Supreme Mother saw that happening, she turned to the Lord and she said, you wanted to create such a beautiful world, and I'm sorry it's gone wrong. What can be done? And then he showed her how to send power of pure love, pure divine love, to set things right. Sorry?
It is Agni.
Agni would be one of the expressions of he's the priest of the sacrifice, no? Who carries our will towards the divine.
My mother said the importance of Savitri is immense. We read that the other day in the exhibit.
Yes.
There's no other hope in the love changing.
We haven't really understood this message, no? As this message of Savitri right at the end, and the people who heard it, they couldn't understand it, and we don't understand it fully. It's on page 724.
Yeah,
awakened to the meaning of my heart, that to feel love and oneness is to live, and this, the magic of our golden chain, is all the truth I know or see or say. And then it says, they wondered at her and her two luminous words. They didn't understand, and we also find it difficult to understand.
Then they went to the West.
then they went back to the human world. They returned to the human world. Many people think, when we started Savitri Bhavan, people said to us, why do you need a building? Savitri is all about the forest. Everything happens in the forest. So it's true. It all happened in the forest. Dhyumatsena was exiled to the forest. But at the end, they have to return to the human world, and they have to start a new age. Wakens by, opens for us by thee a happier age. That's what that sage says. He recognizes that what Savitri has done by bringing Satyavan back to Earth is initiated a new, happier age for humanity. And in a letter, Sri Aurobindo has said, yes, this happened way back in the dawn of human history when it was necessary to open up this possibility. And in Book 11, when the Supreme Lord gives his prophecy, it's clear that it's going to take quite a long time. But now that long time has happened, no? So things should be changing.
And well, I say they definitely are, because our ashram group went to the progress garden this morning. What a glory is that?
If you're feeling discouraged about progress, go over there. We were working to help it when it was under construction, with the pebbles in place. So the fountain is like symbol to me of the bliss coming down. Then you have to come up three levels through all those pebbles and progress flowers. And then you have to come down, and I'm calling it the pool of truth because it's square, no? Like these cushions, full of mother and true vigil. That is where, instead of becoming decadent and old and dried up, we can go into mother.
Fountain of youth.
That's the progress we need to make. This is the greatest time for all though, because now Satchitananda is there, existence, fountain of bliss, and now progress.
In that little film, The Yoga of the Earth, no? The last passage, Mother's speaking about how many times the messengers have come, given the message of light. How many times? But then she says, but this time, something seems to be changing. And if we look carefully, then we will see the change. Those are the last words of the film. The recording. So you are right, Patty, we shouldn't allow disillusion and disappointment and discouragement.
Well, even that love and oneness she talked about is symbolized in that unity garden. And there's six continents, those six circles that represent the six continents of the world. You can go there and pray for the unity of mankind. It's in place. I mean, it's going on now. In process.
But in our lives, we have this longing for love and oneness. And even if it, like it is said here, a little happiness,
Yes.
Yeah, and in any small measure, when we experience truth and love,
yes, we recognize it.
The pain is reduced to that.
Yes.
We probably just pour more love.
Yeah, the yearning heart in things that with a little happiness is on content. But life doesn't allow us to be content with a little happiness. What we're really longing for is bliss.
In that moment, we receive a sense of peace, and then we have to walk forward.
Yes.
And I speak for my life, it's experience.
Yes.
Being fully depressed or desperate, a little touch of love.
Yes, right. Yeah. That's the touch of mother's sunlight.
Yeah. I looked up in Sarvati Concordance the other day, there are 409 references to joy. And I didn't even add in the Ananda, the bliss, the love and light and all that.
Shall we read to the end of the section? Doris.
In rejected heaps by a monotonous road, the old simple delights were left to fly. On the wasteland of life, lives descend tonight. All glory of life was dim, tarnished with doubt. All beauty ended in an aging face. All power was dubbed a tyranny cursed by God. In truth, a fiction needed by the mind. The chase of joy was now a tired hunt. All knowledge was left a question of ignorance.
Yeah, so this is what happens when we lose that frank, spontaneous impulse of the soul. The old simple delights get left aside. So this is actually only the first section. It gets worse. Take our courage in our hands like King Asvapati. And next time we'll read onwards.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.